Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, Simon Schuster, and Mike Milan. A little later, Nick Scimitero. He is with AFSCME. We're going to talk about the teacher pension question that is hanging over the legislature right now. But first, John, over the weekend, the topic was legalizing marijuana and what's going to happen in the gubernatorial race on this. If you're Bill Schuette, and we're going to go back to the medical marijuana debate of 2008, he was opposed to it, not only opposed to it, but the leading voice against it. Now what does he do? Is it okay to say, well, I was really against it then, I'm not as much against it now?
First of all, I think it's an entirely different climate than it was back then. And I think he has to be aware of a couple of things. The libertarians, Republicans/libertarians, that he wants the support of are not going to be enthralled with him if he comes out strongly against this. You have to look at the fact that Canada, our neighbor to the north, is looking at and probably going to legalize it. You've got polls now where that suggest 60% of our voters support legalizing recreational marijuana. So I don't think he can just come out flat out and say I oppose it. I don't think he wins any big popularity contests doing that anymore. If I were him, I would probably look at saying something along the lines of let the people decide. And if they decide it, I'm going to support the law, and that's what the law is going to be.
What have you made out of this, Jack? Because it seems like Schuette has tempered his message on medical marijuana since he's been the attorney general. And legalizing marijuana is a pretty big step from medical marijuana.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting watching he and other candidates and how they handle this particular question. A year, we're talking about over a year of handling the question because it's going to come up again and again and again. And I think you can learn a lot about who they're after in terms of voters and so on as to how they word things and how they position themselves on this. And it's not just at the top of the ticket either. I mean, all the way through down the ticket, ultimately, how are various candidates going to handle this? I think it's going to be very fascinating to see how they position themselves and how they word their positioning.
Because it doesn't necessarily have to be a partisan issue, Simon. I mean, you could have a situation where you have a Democrat who, let's say he or she's running for attorney general, and they want to say they are not in support of legalized marijuana, but you could have a Republican running for governor who's taking the Justin Amash approach and saying, let's take the government out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that there's strains of conservatism that allow for not perhaps the endorsement of legalized marijuana, but it could at least allow for looking the other way, I guess, in regards to consuming the drug. I think what's become more difficult about defending being against legalized marijuana now is that back in 2008, I don't believe a single state had legalized marijuana yet. And you could speak to all of these, you know, what ifs and possibilities and potentially bad outcomes. But now that a number of states have legalized marijuana, you can point to different regulatory schemes. You can point to the outcomes in states that have had marijuana legalized for, you know, going on almost 5 years now. And you can say, look at what's happened in these states, and we can replicate a scheme that would work just as well in Michigan. And that becomes much, much harder to argue against.
If you're a Republican and you're running for governor, Mike, do you kind of sense how the rest of the field is going? Because it seems like you could have an advantage if you're the one who's tough on marijuana and you can kind of play to that crowd.
Yes, absolutely. The conservative base is still not going to want to legalize marijuana, but libertarian strains within the Republican Party can make a case for decriminalization, at least. I think on the Democratic side, a lot of people are going to be talking about that you've criminalized a number of people who otherwise they'd be law-abiding citizens, except they are smoking this weed.
All right, so we're going to presume then that Bill Schuette is going to be a little mushy on this. So what about Callie? Should he be, where do you think he ends up? Does he have an advantage being more firm on this one way or the other, or should he be mushy?
I think he's going to wind up being mushy too. That's just a prediction. I could be wrong, but I don't see an advantage of him coming out strongly against it. And I don't think there's an advantage for him to come out strongly for it. I think the issue is at the stage, and his candidacy is at the stage where he has to kind of just back away and say, this is going to go, if this is going to go in front of the people of the state of Michigan to decide, we're going to respect their decision, and that's what we're going to do.
Agree, Jack?
Yes, I think you have to remember that as the thing moves forward, there are all kinds of ways that you can handle this kind of this sort of thing. I mean, potentially a candidate could say, I had an open mind to it until I saw the actual wording on the ballot, and then find some problem with the actual wording on the ballot. Or there's the other way around it of saying something like, you know, I had an open mind to this, and I think it's something the state ought to consider, but until I found out that the people behind it are actually just positioning themselves to be able to make a financial killing on it. I mean, there are so many variations of how you can play this thing. That's why I think it's going to be so interesting to see how they handle it, because I think if you look at how they play it, you may be able to sense, okay, what are they seeing in the polling? Why are they positioning themselves that way, et cetera? I think the other big issue that I'm not sure anyone's talking about on this is they're going to be well-financed opposition to it, and I don't think we know that yet.
That's a good question. Who comes together and finances a no operation? Is this the sheriffs? Do they want to even bother spending money? Is it worth spending money on?
I don't know, because I don't know what law enforcement thinks about this anymore. You know, I have to believe there it's causing them probably maybe less trouble than the drug that's been legal forever, alcohol.
Well, not only that, or opioids. That's the other thing, too. I mean, we've got a prescription drug issue in this state and in this country right now where people are addicting themselves on painkillers, and if they're not getting the painkillers, then heroin. That is a good question. Simon, what do you think ends up being the no campaign?
I mean, I think that that's a really tough question, Kyle, because this is an argument that's becoming less and less defensible. If you look at Colorado, for example, who has kind of been the vanguard of marijuana legalization, they have a Republican attorney general. Her name's Cynthia Kaufman. And when at the beginning of the Trump administration, when Jeff Sessions was calling marijuana only slightly better than opioids, she invited him to come out and see the state's recreational system. And I think that they're, in terms of a no campaign, I think they would have to relate more to perhaps worse. Yeah, fears, and especially they'd have to play to parents who are concerned about the idea of that if it is readily available in a recreational setting, that it would trickle down to their children and high school possession. I think that if you do make marijuana regulated similarly to alcohol, then I think that teenagers will, there will be some that will want to, you know, follow the law to the book, and there will be others that will be caught in their parents' basements with, you know, a bottle.
I don't know if legalizing marijuana, Mike, is going to have a heck of a lot of difference on whether kids are going to have access to it. Seems like if you really want it, you can get
high one way or another.
Right,
yeah.
They'll get it one way or the other. But anyway, let's move on to another question you mentioned earlier today, John. I think it's a really good one. When is the Flint water crisis over? And who declares that the Flint water crisis is over? Or is this something that just kind of trickles on until one day we wake up and realize, geez, I guess we don't have a crisis anymore?
Well, we just had the eighth straight test where the city tested below the federal limit of 15 parts per billion. They're at 6 parts per billion. What I'm curious about is how many other cities have the same level or higher. And there's really no political advantage for Rick Snyder or his DEQ to say, we're waving the green flag and it's time for Flint to be able to know that they can use their water, drink their water, et cetera, without filtration. There's no incentive politically for the EPA, which also had a hand in this whole situation. There's really no incentive for city officials to do it either.
Because they want to keep the gravy train running. They're getting all sorts of money.
They're getting all sorts of attention. They're getting all sorts of aid. There may be a disincentive for them to want to call for it, although there could be a political advantage for Karen Weaver at some point to say it is now fixed and I was the one that led the city out of it. But I don't think that's anywhere near on the horizon.
Right. I mean, because as long as you're still getting money to help the kids, yeah, and you're getting money for the pipes, and we still got a filtration system there, the water plant that hasn't been fixed yet, and they don't have the money for that check, who ends up saying that the Flint water crisis is over?
If I had to bet, I'd say somebody more than 10 years from now says, back when we had the Flint water crisis. I think it's just
something that fades out over time.
Nobody's going to just declare it, because you look too bad if you declare that it's over and then there's bad reading or there's some other thing. It might be even something that doesn't even really pertain to the original problem. But if something pops up, then look how bad you look.
But take a look at everything that we've seen so far, Simon. The readings are down. They've got the water pipes that are on schedule till what? They're going to be in the ground allegedly by the year 2020. You could say that at a certain point, that you can wave the green flag and say that it's okay. And what about Brian Kelly? I mean, he could make a pronouncement a year from now after all these good readings, take a gamble and take credit for helping the city out of the Flint water crisis.
Well, I mean, certainly there is that possibility, but I think that your perception of when the Flint water crisis is over is entirely determined by your perspective. All the points that have been made around this table, I think, are very valid, that you know, that there has a settlement has been reached in court that shows that all the lead service lines are going to be replaced within 3 years. And so from that perspective, from the perspective of regulatory compliance, that I think that that it is a dwindling crisis from that regard. However, there are people out there that look at this from a fundamentally different aspect. There are public health experts, there are epidemiologists who are saying that this is not something that's going to be over in a few years. Because of the fact that there are children that were lead poisoned in this, it's going to have a societal impact that could stretch out for decades. So from an infrastructure and from perhaps a fiscal standpoint, you could argue that, you know, the state's hands have been wiped clean.
You can continue to monitor those children and their impact long term and still say, all right, our water is the same quality as Grand Rapids or Saginaw or wherever, and it's okay now to drink and declare this immediate consumption crisis at an end.
And yes, you can. I think that would certainly be within reason within a few years. But for the people that want to maintain, you know, public health advocacy for the residents of Flint and the people that were impacted, because if the data is correct and there was an analysis that says in aggregate that children's IQs were damaged, that economic benefits were lost, then from a political standpoint, this is something that could be argued decades out, that this is something that Flint, because, you know, this is a result of state action, that this is something that Flint residents should be compensated for far into the future.
Well, I understand, but there's got to be an end to this, right?
Well, it won't come before November of 2018. Democrats want this to be a referendum on the emergency manager law, Snyder's performance, and therefore Kelly's performance. Democrats will keep this issue alive for at least a year and a half.
It's going to be really hard, though, to make that case when you're going to, at that point, presumably have 24 months of testing that shows this water quality, the lead content of the water, is at 6 parts per billion. I mean, nobody is going to believe it.
I should make an addendum to what I said. I was talking about politicians. I'm sure real estate people, I'm sure people promoting economics in the city of Flint may already be saying it to somebody.
But then the crisis is over?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what are you going to do if you're trying to sell a house or you're trying to, you know, get a company to move in? But it's in terms of politicians, I just think they'd be trading it off. You say it first, no, you say it first, no, you say it first. I think there'd be some real problems with the fear of something happening. Again, would it have to technically even be the same thing or just something else popping up and making you look bad? I think people let somebody else declare it.
From my perspective, I don't think that the Flint water crisis will ever be officially declared over. I think that there will be a celebration and a trumpeting when citywide the water is considered consumable without filters anywhere. That's going to be something that will be championed and trumpeted. But I don't think that it will be ever politically tenable to say that the crisis is over, especially for people, because you are putting at risk your support in a city of 100,000 people. And I think that it's simply going to fade away as political will erodes.
I don't know. It seems like there is a political benefit for somebody at some point to say, we've got this taken care of, nothing to see here, come on, move into Flint because we've got new water pipes or they're on the way, this is a city on the comeback, you can drink the water, hey look, I'm going to guzzle a 2-liter right now, or I'm going to drink out of this hose or whatever. I just think that it's going to happen at some point because it's advantage, it's there is a political advantage to somebody at some point to do so.
There could be. I mean, if you lay the groundwork the right way, I mean, if as you mentioned, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, he could certainly go up there and have a big press conference and say, you know, 24 months we've had clean water below the standard. It's drinkable now. The filters are coming off. We made a commitment. Maybe he can work out a deal where he accelerates those lead pipe replacements and brings them in August of 2018.
You know? And look, just statewide. I mean, there's already Flint fatigue statewide. And oh, yeah. So if you're looking at a statewide audience, just not the city of Flint. I mean, the city of Flint could go tell Kelly or whoever to go, you know, jump in a pool of water himself. You know, you're all wet. Forget you. But if you're living up in Ontonagon or you're living in Kentwood or you're living in downriver, you're like, oh, thank God, we're finally over with that already. And if Kelly can say, I'm the one who helped make it happen, well, shoot, kudos for him. While the city of Flint and You know, I think a smaller group of people would say, well, hey, wait a minute here.
I'm not sure if Brian Kelly is going to carry the city of Flint anyway.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's the opposite. I think if somebody's going to do it, it's going to be somebody locally for some reason.
Weaver?
To make Flint look more acceptable and more, you know, inviting to visit or whatever. I don't think it would be from outside. But I just keep picturing, you know, a certain president, George W., on the deck of a ship that said mission accomplished. I think that kind of thing is going to backfire, and I think any politician is going to have to be afraid of that.
Let's hope nobody gets an aircraft carrier up the Flint River.
that would be a news story, wouldn't it? All right, let's move on to the interview segment here. Joining us now on the podcast is the legislative director for AFSCME, Nick Scimentaro. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you just got back from the governor's task force on municipal post-retirement benefits, and we were supposed to get a report at some point. Where are we on that thing?
Well, we're making substantial progress. It's the governor's task force on responsible retirement reform, I think is the name of it.
Okay, all right. But it's municipal retirement post-benefits.
It has discussed both pensions, 401k, so, and other post-employment benefits, primarily health care, and how we make sure that they're safe and they continue and without jeopardizing current employees.
So how far away are we from a report?
I think a few weeks, yeah, a couple of weeks anyways. We made a great deal of progress today. We essentially agreed we weren't going to meet as a group again. We have a draft that we had agreement in concept at the beginning part and the end part, and the middle part will probably reflect the consensus and majority opinions we reached at the two ends, just the way the report is structured. There'll be another rewrite, it'll be distributed, and then we'll try to finalize the wordsmithing, etc., by way of email rather than pulling everybody in a room and letting us glare at each other.
How do you think this is all gone?
The task force, I think, that's sort of the approach to governing, I think, that is best, that you bring in people who don't agree and who have different stakes in the outcome and try to talk through to something that people can live with, as opposed to one side or the other just saying, okay, here's how you fix it. I always learn something in those settings, and I think they tend toward a better result in the end. This one hasn't gotten there in a number of areas, that is, hasn't gotten to agreement or consensus. I think with more time we could. But the world being what it is today, you know, everybody's in a hurry, I guess. So I think we will have some good recommendations, and then I think we'll be saying, okay, there was an agreement on several different things.
If you had the governor's ear, would you tell him, give us another 2 months?
Oh, yeah. Clearly there are a lot of issues that could be helpful in resolving the problem. And remember, this is not a problem that occurred yesterday. This is a 40, 50-year-old problem in the making, and that a lot of us have been talking about for that 40, 50 years. But, you know, there are a lot of options that amongst the members themselves we never got to because of time. And, yeah, I definitely would think another couple of months would be real helpful. But being what it's being, we'll report what we've got. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe part of that report will ultimately say, in fact, I think at one point it did say, we were saying, you know, this is a beginning, not an end to the issue.
Is this a problem that you think an AFSCME could reach an agreement? That we could wind up with a unanimous consensus that this is the way forward?
Given more time,
yeah. I don't think we're there. I mean, there are elements of this report, and the report is being written in a way that says, okay, here are the things we all agree on, and AFSCME has agreed on those things we all agreed on. But there's a good portion of it that says we have differences of opinion on this, here are the differences of opinion, and we haven't gotten to discussions of a whole lot of other things.
Speaker Leonard says that that system needs to be closed. Mesper's needs to be closed. Is there another solution?
You just switched to another topic, but that's okay.
Yeah, we were going to get there anyway, so let's go ahead and make that transition. Quick transition here to the teacher pension measures.
Now, understand, when we're talking about municipal pension systems, we're talking about hundreds of different plans that are locally decided. When we're talking about school employees, we're talking about one statutory plan that applies to all K-12 employees in traditional public schools, a lot of community colleges, and a number of university employees. So it's a different issue, and it's a different approach. One is, you know, we're dealing with these locally negotiated agreements, and the other is a statute, basically. I agree with the governor that the MPSR system as we have it with the last reforms, with the 2012 reforms, creating a hybrid system is working. It's 100% pre-funded in the hybrid portion, and the major costs are in the old system. So I think we've pretty much fixed that. I think the problem with Speaker Leonard's position, and where I would disagree with Speaker Leonard and with Majority Leader Meekhoff, is that they're arguing at this point that we should spend an enormous amount of money to close a system that's basically working and create a system that provides significantly less benefits to the people involved. Now, it's one thing when an employer comes to me and say, we can't afford this benefit, we've got to look at it. I understand that, but it's another thing to come to me and say, we need to spend $500 million a year or more to reduce benefits we're paying our employees. That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, you could argue, though, that pensions in general are dinosaurs. They don't work anymore. Nobody offers them except government. It's time to move on and give people flexible tools that they can use in their next job and the job after that, and 401ks are just that.
But hybrids incorporate 401ks. So the original argument in that direction, which is now the dinosaur argument, is that people could do better in the investments on their own than government could do for them, or that a pension plan board could do for them. That's proved to be completely wrong. It's just the opposite. And it's the opposite for a couple of reasons. One is the opposite because you have a smaller pool to work with. Everybody knows it takes money to make money, right? Two is that you don't have, individuals don't have the time to constantly monitor markets and bond markets. And three, most importantly, is that as you age, whether it's as an individual or a closed plan, which we found with the state employees plan, as you age, your investments have to be more and more conservative, which means they are less and less lucrative because you have no time to recover. The example is clear. The hybrid system is working. It's 100% funded. It splits the risk between the employer and the employee rather than laying it all on one or the other. The opposite example, the other example that we have that's been in place, is the state employees plan. Now, the state employees retirement system was closed in 1998, 20 years ago, and all of the new hires were then moved to 401ks. If that was such a great plan, the facts belie that suggestion, because we went from a plan that was 107 or 109% funded with an annual contribution from the employer requirement of about 12%. Fast forward 20 years, we now have all in the 401k plans, a plan that the remaining defined benefit plan, because you've got to continue that on for the people who are still alive and had vested in benefits before, now has an accrued unfunded liability. They're only funded at less than 60% for the first time, and it's been continually declining. And the annual contribution rate for both plans is approaching 40%. So that doesn't work. Now, that's not to say you don't look for things to do, but you don't do something that has specifically not worked. The reason I say it's less benefits is the National Institute of Retirement Services did a study of closed pension plans, those that said new hires go into 401k, and found, and in their study, they looked specifically at the Michigan plan because it's one of the older ones. As I said, it was done in 1998. And if you take the 401k plans and do all the actuarial good stuff that I don't understand, and well, everybody's eyes will glaze over if I did and could explain it, and translated that into a lifetime annuity. That annuity, for all the additional money we're spending, would be 20 to 22% less than what the pension plan. So you're spending a lot more money to get people a lot less benefit. And we don't have to look very far. We just look across the street from the MIBSERS plan, experience in the same department, from the MIBSERS plan for public school employees to the state employees plan, which did what is being proposed 20 years ago, and see what's happened today.
You kind of answered my question, but the membership that you represent, what percentage are 401k? What percentage are pension now?
Again, that's part of the problem. You asked why we needed more time on the municipal side. Most of my members are in the municipal. About 10% are in schools. About 10% are in state government. The rest are in municipal plans. There are 1,800 different plans. I have, within AFSCME, 600 different plans. Okay. And so trying to compile that data is problematic. For the state to compile it for everybody is impossible. But to answer to your question, generally speaking, the move in the past had been toward 401ks. The greater move today in both the public and private sector are toward the hybrid plans. And in fact, in the public sector side, there are two states, West Virginia and Connecticut, that within the last year have closed their 401k plans and reopened their pension plans in order to save money.
Well, that was my kind of the angle I was hitting at. If you look at just the folks that were pushed into the 401k movement, do you think in 10 or 15 years when these individuals hit retirement age, are we looking at a public policy issue or crisis when they realize they don't have the money to retire?
If you combine what we've done in the 401ks, the movement to 401ks, which has not worked. Again, you know, we all make mistakes. I'm not being critical of folks, but we all make mistakes, but we kind of like to try to make new ones now and then instead of doing the same. If it didn't work, you don't do it again, is the message I think you have to make. But if you look at both public and private sector, the move toward 401ks and the elimination of other post-employment benefits, health care basically for retirees, or the reductions in that, maybe not in 10 years, but certainly within the next 30 years, we are looking at, I believe, a huge crisis in healthcare costs because they won't have enough to pay in their health retirement accounts to pay for pensions, pay for premiums. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they'll end up with a healthcare crisis and a retirement. We already have a retirement crisis in that a lot of people are working well past the normal retirement age, whatever you want to call that to be. But you have a more immediate problem that's happening now, and that's with the fact that most pension plans and most benefits are negotiated at the bargaining table in lieu of pay increases, with the lower pay levels that the public sector still continues to pay when adjusted for educational attainment level and their benefit levels, and their including their retirement benefit levels, we are already, with what we've done to date, having a tremendous crisis in terms of being able to hire people to do essential state services. There's a teacher shortage in the state because you can go to other states that give better benefits. I talked to a police chief late last week who advised me that he has never seen it this bad in terms of trying to recruit police officers. The head of the firefighters union has told me that there's a crisis in finding people who are willing to sign on as firefighters, at least qualified people. So you've got to balance out the remuneration and the security, and most people want to have security for themselves or their families, versus the ability to hire at all. And you counter that with the fact that then you're going to have people working well past their retirement years. Now, in some professions, police and fire in particular, you don't want that to happen. You want them to retire earlier because there's an amount of physical endurance involved. That's true for some of my members who do road work and other construction work. And the problem is that if you look at the real cost in other than post-employment benefits, retiree health care, the cost is not so much at the post-65 level, because you could coordinate with Medicare, and almost all do. But the pre-65 and police and fire, a large percentage of which are not covered by Medicare. So that's where your problem lies, and that's where we need to find some revenue to deal with that crisis. If you force a police officer to work till he's 70, you may not be happy with the result. If you force a fire, I don't know that I want a 70-year-old firefighter pulling me out of a burning building.
No.
You need some level of stamina that, though there are some 70-year-olds who have that level of stamina, I'm 65, and I don't think I could do the work of a firefighter.
Well, let me just close with this. You are a former lawmaker. How long did you serve, and what year were you done?
I served for 20 years, and I was one of the first term limit bunch. I like to say it took a constitutional amendment to get rid of me. I left at the end of 1998.
What do you think has been, just real quickly, the biggest problem with term limits?
I think the biggest problem with term limits is a lack of history and knowledge of things that we've tried before. So you inevitably start trying the same things that failed that you tried before, and a lack of mentoring, the ability to mentor. When I was a young legislator, I could go to legislators who had been around a while with an idea, and many times they would say to me, yeah, it sounds like a great idea, but we tried it 10 years ago and it didn't work, so don't do that. They're not in a position to be able to do that. They're very bright, they're very intelligent people, but they have, in any job, it's nice to have somebody who's been around for a while who can mentor you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Nick Chimintero, he's with AFSCME, Legislative Director. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here. John, good to have you back. Most exciting part of your vacation was?
Sleeping in for 2 weeks.
Oh, jeez. And it wasn't coming in and seeing Lori stream your door with black streamers.
That was nice. I've got to go clean out about 50 balloons out of my office. So.
Do you remember this, Jack, when Shantae put the black streamers over your desk when you turned the big 5-0?
Yeah, I remember that. And what amazed me is they were still up when I turned the big 5-5.
I thought I'd torn them down, but there were still some that were hanging from the rafters for a while, wasn't there?
Yeah, quite a while. Good tape. Good.
You only got quality tape here at MERS.
It's the tape. It's not that we aren't interested in actually pulling the stuff down. Oh, and by the way, I don't know if Emily made these cookies for you, but have you had one of the Emily Lawler cookies?
I'm about to. I'm saving it for my mid-morning brunch.
I was actually thinking the same thing. Simon, how were they?
Good. Rich.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Emily Lawler from MLive, for supplying these cookies. I think she dropped them off today so that she'd get a shout-out on the podcast, too. Congratulations, Emily. Successful on that. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the crew. Thanks to Nick and Kyle Malin. And also thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all the other podcasts as well. I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.